Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the teleclass, Do Staphylococcal Decolonization Strategies Work? You may be able to tell that I am not Nicole Kenny, who was supposed to host this teleclass. Nicole, ironically, has a viral infection and sounds very much like an 80-year-old chain smoker, so she asked me to stand in for her. This is Dr. Andrew Seymour's third teleclass lecture, and it, in fact, comes directly as a result of the second teleclass lecture that he gave in 2009. The title of that one was The Changing Face of MRSA. It's available in the recordings library if you'd like to go and have a look and listen. During that teleclass, he speculated ever so briefly on decolonizing and whether decolonizing MRSA was of any use. I telephoned him immediately after that lecture to book this third teleclass lecture, and I am glad that I did. Dr. Seymour is a national and international leader in the field of hospital epidemiology. His home base is at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto and also at the University of Toronto, where he is, in fact, a multiple award-winning researcher and teacher. His work takes him around the world, and most notably, and I think repeatedly, to Zimbabwe, where he has done a lot of work in rural hospitals to develop HIV and tuberculosis clinics. He is a man of many talents. I respect him a great deal and like him a great deal, and it is a great honor to be able to spend this time with him and with you all. All that said, I will stop gushing and turn the floor over to Dr. Andrew Seymour. Andy.
Thank you, Paul. And good morning or good afternoon, depending on where in the world you are at this moment. As Paul mentioned, I've been asked to talk about or try to address the question of whether staphylococcal decolonization strategies work. And although this subject arose out of a presentation related to MRSA, today's presentation will in fact be broader to encompass not only MRSA, but also the potential role of decolonization in those who are colonized with susceptible strains of Staph aureus. And I must say that in the past few years, this has really become a very hot topic and a somewhat contentious topic. Pretty well every week now, I'm contacted by one of my colleagues in infectious diseases or in infection prevention and control asking about whether their particular patient or group of patients who are carrying Staph aureus would benefit from decolonization. So it is a question that's very interesting. And what I hope to do with you is to review the evidence either for or against decolonization and try to address its role in a variety of different clinical scenarios. The second slide, if you want to start advancing, is really just my disclosure slide, and in fact, I have no disclosures to make with regards to this presentation. And the next slide summarizes the objectives for the next three quarters of an hour or so. And what I'd like to discuss with you is the rationale for staphylococcal decolonization that might be considered, to review evidence for decolonization as a strategy for staphylococcal infection prevention, and then based upon that review and the evidence that's available, come up with my own personal editorialization, if you like, my own recommendations as to when one might appropriately consider staphylococcal decolonization as a strategy. So those are the objectives over the next little while. I think it's helpful to begin by understanding a little bit about staphylococcal colonization if we're going to talk about decolonization. So the next slide merely reminds us all that the major ecologic and anatomic niche for Staph aureus is the anterior nares, and that is the single most common and predominant site of staphylococcal colonization, regardless of whether it is a susceptible strain or a methicillin-resistant strain. However, it is obviously not the only anatomic site. Certainly, staphylococci may colonize virtually any mucosal surface or cutaneous surface of the body, but other common sites besides the nose include the oropharynx, the axilla, the perineum and perianal areas, as well as other chronic skin lesions or wounds, wound ulcers, areas of eczema or dermatitis or psoriasis, for example. The next slide just highlights that on average, somewhere between 25 and 30% of individuals will be found to carry Staph aureus at any point in time. These are data from a large National Health and Nutrition Examination survey conducted in the United States involving many thousands of healthy individuals in the United States who were sampled as part of health evaluation for staphylococcal carriage. And as you can see, that the prevalence was about 29% of Staph aureus overall. And in this U.S. population, 1.5% were also found to be asymptomatically colonized with MRSA. Although the staphylococcal, overall staphylococcal colonization rates in a Canadian population are about the same, again, close to 30%, we actually don't have Canadian data about MRSA colonization in the population at large, but I would speculate that it's probably less than the U.S. rates, less than 1.5%, and I would probably guesstimate probably under 1% overall. Nonetheless, a significant number of individuals in our community will be carrying either susceptible strains of Staph aureus or methicillin-resistant strains. The next slide illustrates the results of numerous studies that have confirmed different patterns of staphylococcal carriage. There are some individuals, averaging in most studies around 20%, who have what is defined as persistent nasal carriage of Staph aureus. And what that means is that they tend to carry Staph aureus in the nasal mucosa for prolonged periods of time, months or even years at a time, typically with the same strain over these prolonged periods of time. A second pattern of carriage, which may be a little more common, occurring in about 30% overall, has been described as intermittent carriage. And these are individuals who may pick up a strain of Staph aureus and carry it in the nose for several weeks or maybe a few months, and then spontaneously will lose or clear that carriage so that for several weeks or several months they're not carrying any strain of Staph aureus at all, and then eventually may pick up a new strain and carry that for a temporary short period of time, some weeks or months, before that strain is lost and spontaneously cleared. So this is a pattern of intermittent carriage. And what that means is that about half of us either carry Staph aureus in the nose persistently or intermittently. However, the other half of us are described as being non-carriers or infrequent carriers. And these are individuals who don't seem to carry Staph aureus in the nose ever, or if they do, very infrequently for very brief periods of time. And again, that's about half of us as well. The reasons for these different patterns of staphylococcal nasal carriage are not well understood. There are presumably a number of genetic factors that might predispose to staphylococcal carriage or resistance to carriage. There may be factors related to different nasal mucosal receptors that either bind Staph aureus preferentially or indeed prefer not to bind Staph aureus. And as I say, those details are not well understood. What has become clear, however, is that when Staph aureus is carried in the nose, it's typically in the anterior nares, the anterior portion of the nostril, and often involves the hair follicles. And the reason I emphasize the hair follicles of the nose here is because when you have staphylococcal colonization within a hair follicle, it actually may make it more difficult to eradicate the carrier state, because that's a relatively protected environment, regardless of whether you use a systemic or a topical agent to try to eradicate that carriage. So there are a number of factors that we still don't clearly understand about staphylococcal carriage, and that obviously places a challenge for us when we think about decolonization strategies. Another important factor to keep in mind is that there are some patient populations who may in fact be predisposed to higher rates of staphylococcal carriage, and that's shown on the next slide, where there are listed a number of risk factors that increase the risk of being a staphylococcal carriage. And these include people who have chronic skin conditions like atopic dermatitis. They are often chronically, persistently, heavily colonized with Staph aureus. Diabetics, particularly those who are insulin dependent with frequent insulin injections, also have higher rates of staphylococcal colonization. Patients who are on hemodialysis have higher rates, and intravenous drug users have higher rates. And you can appreciate those three categories, the insulin-dependent diabetic, the hemodialysis patient, the IV drug user, what they all have in common are frequent percutaneous breaks in the skin by needles. And for poorly understood reasons, these factors seem to increase staphylococcal carriage. And also on the list, HIV-infected individuals also seem to have a higher risk of Staph aureus colonization. So the question that arises is, if patients were just colonized with Staph aureus, we wouldn't be very fussed about it because the colonization status implies that they are just asymptomatically carrying the organism and it's not doing very much. The problem is that being a Staph aureus carrier, being colonized with Staph aureus, does have important clinical implications. And those are shown on the next slide, entitled Significance of Staph aureus Nasal Carriage. And very briefly put, if you carry Staph aureus in your nose and then you are admitted to hospital, that places you at a substantially increased risk of developing a nosocomial or hospital-acquired staphylococcal infection. And that's been shown in a variety of different clinical scenarios and a variety of different Staph aureus infections. And you can see, for example, a handful of references here, and these are just examples of references, that if you are a nasal carrier of Staph aureus on admission to hospital, you are 2 to 5 times more likely to develop nosocomial Staph aureus bacteremia as compared to an individual who is not a Staph aureus carrier. Similarly, if you're a Staph aureus carrier and undergoing hemodialysis, you are at an increased risk of developing a staphylococcal bloodstream infection or Staph aureus exit site infection. And similarly, if you undergo a surgical procedure when you are a Staph aureus carrier, in various studies you will have a 2 to 9-fold increased risk of developing a Staph aureus surgical site infection. And finally, if you're a Staph aureus carrier and you're admitted to an ICU, there is a 2 to 5-fold increased risk of developing a Staph aureus infection during your ICU hospital stay as compared to an individual who is not a staphylococcal carrier. So having Staph aureus colonization and being admitted to hospital has important clinical significance. And as the next slide shows, that may be even more significant if your Staph aureus strain is methicillin resistant. Colonization with MRSA is associated with an even greater risk of subsequent infection. And you can see in one study, nasal carriers of MRSA were almost 4 times more likely to develop a nosocomial staphylococcal bacteremia than were carriers of susceptible strains of Staph aureus, and similarly about a 4-fold increased risk of an ICU-acquired MRSA infection if you were MRSA colonized on admission to the ICU as compared to being colonized with a susceptible strain or not being colonized at all. And in fact, the next slide shows if you are found to be newly colonized with MRSA during a hospital stay, and you know, as you know, many or most Canadian hospitals do a substantial amount of screening for MRSA colonization. Well, every time you newly identify an MRSA carrier in your hospital, these studies indicate that somewhere between 20 to 30% of these individuals will develop an MRSA infection if you follow them for somewhere between 12 and 18 months. So that's a pretty substantial risk of infection occurring as part of the natural history of being colonized with an organism like MRSA. So with that background, understanding that staphylococcal colonization is common, and if you are admitted to hospital or undergo some medical or surgical procedure and you are colonized, you have a substantially increased risk of infection occurring, that sort of provides the rationale for decolonization. And for the purposes of my presentation, I'm going to define decolonization as shown in this slide, treatment to eradicate staphylococcal carriage. So that's what I mean when I use the term decolonization. The next slide just illustrates the number of different agents that have been used to attempt staph aureus decolonization. And I'll quickly say, even this is not a complete list. I didn't want to crowd the slide too much, but highlight some of the more commonly used agents that have been tried. And you can see the approaches have included a variety of topical agents, ointments and creams, for example, as well as a number of systemic agents, primarily given orally. Most of the published data has been with mupirocin or Bactroban as a topical ointment or cream, and most of the data I'm going to present will deal with mupirocin as a decolonizing agent, but you need to be aware that a number of other approaches have also been attempted, and I will allude to some of them in the course of my presentation. I will also quickly mention most of these agents have in fact been relatively ineffective, and that's why I'm not going to talk very much about them other than to say that they haven't been very useful. I will present data on some of the more useful agents that have been used. The next slide just points out that there are in fact at least two different reasons why one might consider staphylococcal decolonization. And the first is to actually try to prevent an infection in a colonized patient, and that would be relevant for both susceptible strains of Staph aureus as well as for resistant strains. You have a colonized patient, you know that in hospital they have an increased risk of infection, especially if they're admitted to an ICU or undergo a surgical procedure or require hemodialysis. Wouldn't it be wonderful to decolonize them to prevent that infection from occurring in that individual patient? The second rationale, however, isn't directly related to preventing a specific infection, but rather is maybe using it as a strategy as part of infection prevention and control. And we've all considered this if we've had clusters or outbreaks of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Might the use of decolonization limit transmission of the organism by removing the asymptomatically colonized reservoir of the organism? So a second potential reservoir rationale is to prevent transmission, primarily that of MRSA, to other individuals. And of course, in so doing, you are also hoping that you will reduce infection rates. But here, the strategy is used as an infection prevention and control measure. In addition, as the next slide illustrates, there may be two different goals of decolonization in terms of how long the decolonization needs to be effective for. One might consider short-term decolonization, that is, you've actually eradicated the Staph aureus colonization for a relatively short period of time, a matter of days or weeks, and that may be most relevant in patients undergoing surgery because the surgical procedure is in a defined period of time and the risk of a surgical site infection is within a defined period of time. Similarly, potentially if there's a brief or transient ICU admission, short-term decolonization may be effective in that setting as well. In contrast, if you're dealing with a patient who is on long-term hemodialysis or who has had recurrent skin and soft tissue infections, or if you're considering it as an infection prevention control measure, you may actually need long-term decolonization. To decolonize for a few days or a few weeks isn't going to do it if the patient's going to be there for months at a time. You need long-term decolonization. So those are the two different strategies to think about there as well. So the next slide highlights a number of different clinical scenarios where decolonization may be considered, and what I would like to do in the remaining time is to highlight what's the evidence for the use of decolonization in these various scenarios. Does it work in surgical patients? Will it work in non-surgical patients? What's its role in the ICU? How about in dialysis patients? What about individuals who have recurrent skin and soft tissue infections due to Staph aureus or MRSA? And lastly, what about the role of MRSA decolonization as an infection prevention or control measure? The next slide just highlights an area that I'm not going to discuss any further than this one slide, and that is to say decolonization of healthcare workers. Obviously, that may be considered as part of infection control measures as well. And I just highlight that the use of mupirocin has been found to be effective for decolonizing both susceptible Staph aureus as well as resistant strains of Staph aureus in healthcare workers, keeping in mind that, of course, healthcare workers are not the same patient population as our patients undergoing surgery or in an intensive care unit or undergoing dialysis. But I really just wanted to highlight that mupirocin does seem to be highly effective in decolonizing young, healthy adults who are working as healthcare workers. The next slide then moves us into the category of surgical patients and the role of decolonization in surgical patients. Up until recently, there were numerous non-randomized studies that suggested staphylococcal decolonization preoperatively would be an effective measure. The problem with these studies is that, as I mentioned, they were not randomized controlled trials. They were basically cohort studies that may have used historic controls. And those kinds of studies are, of course, subject to all sorts of biases that may render the results non-reliable. The study that is shown in the next one, the study by Seegers, published in JAMA in 2006, is a randomized controlled trial. And it's not truly a decolonization study, but I thought it would be worth highlighting here anyway. This study used chlorhexidine gluconate, both applied as a nasopharyngeal wash and an oropharyngeal wash in patients who underwent cardiac surgery. They were then followed in the post-op period to determine whether they developed staphylococcal nosocomial infections. And the only reason I say it's not a true decolonization therapy is that this isn't directed at staphylococcal decolonization. Obviously, it has a number of other broader effects in addition to eradication of Staph aureus. But what they found in this study is that, in fact, those individuals who received treatment with the chlorhexidine gluconate did have decreased staphylococcal carriage, and that seemed to be associated with a decrease in nosocomial Staph aureus infections, and particularly a lower incidence of postoperative Staph aureus pneumonias and postoperative deep surgical site infections, suggesting that this may be a valuable strategy. However, and I'd like to now move to the next slide, mupirocin has also been tried specifically as a decolonizing agent for patients undergoing surgical procedures to try to reduce the risk of staphylococcal surgical site infections. And there have now been 5 prospective randomized controlled trials of using mupirocin in the perioperative period. Most of these studies, disappointingly, did not show any effect on surgical site infections overall or specifically on Staph aureus surgical site infections. However, 2 studies have suggested effectiveness using perioperative mupirocin prophylaxis to reduce the risk of Staph aureus infections. And I'd like to highlight these randomized controlled trials in the next slide, which is a table showing all 5 of the studies. The first study that I want to highlight is the one that is labeled number 1. It's the largest study involving some 3,800 patients by Trish Pearl, published in the New England Journal of Medicine some 8 years ago now. And this was a large randomized controlled trial of a variety of elective surgical procedures. And basically, any patient undergoing this procedure was randomized to receive perioperative mupirocin or a placebo. And as you can see, overall, there was virtually no difference in Staph aureus surgical site infection rates, nor was there a significant difference in overall surgical site infection rates. The reason this study is important, though, is because they did do a subset analysis, and that is, although all patients who had surgery were randomized, they also did preoperative nasal cultures to determine who was colonized and who wasn't. And that subset of patients who were preoperatively colonized with Staph aureus, who then received mupirocin, that subset appeared to benefit. In that subset, there was a reduced incidence of Staph aureus surgical site infections. So that was an important observation. Studies 2 and 3, as you can see, are much smaller studies in specialized patient populations, either orthopedic surgical patients or gastrointestinal patients. And again, all of those patients were randomized to receive either mupirocin or placebo. Again, no benefit was identified. Study 4 is also a small study, only in cardiac patients. It's asterisked because that study only randomized patients known to be colonized with Staph aureus. So that's the subset that was of interest in the Trish Pearl study. But in contrast to the Trish Pearl study, in this study, this is study number 4, there was no apparent benefit of the mupirocin. There was no reduction in staphylococcal surgical site infections in these cardiac patients, nor was there a reduction in overall infection rates. So that was a bit of a disappointment, albeit a smaller study. Perhaps the most compelling data come from the 5th most recent study that's labeled here as number 5. It's the study by Bode and colleagues that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier this year. And if we move to the next slide, it basically highlights this study that was conducted in 2 Dutch hospitals. There were a total of 808 patients who were randomized. These patients were found to have preoperative nasal colonization with Staph aureus. This was detected by a real-time PCR assay. And those patients in whom the PCR assay was positive for Staph aureus, they were then randomized to either receive decolonization with a combination of mupirocin intranasally plus a chlorhexidine body wash, or they got placebo. So that is the basic study design. The next slide illustrates the results. As I've mentioned, 808 patients were randomized. These were elective surgical patients, a variety of surgical procedures involved, orthopedic, cardiac, gastrointestinal, general surgery, and so forth. And as you can see, there were about 441 patients randomized to receive mupirocin chlorhexidine, 367 received placebo, and the results are summarized here. There was a significant reduction in Staph aureus deep surgical site infections, and there was a trend, albeit not statistically significant, for a decrease in superficial surgical site infections. There was no difference in any other Staph aureus infection identified. So these are the best data that we have available from a properly conducted, rigorous, randomized controlled trial suggesting a benefit of mupirocin plus chlorhexidine given to patients known to be colonized with Staph aureus preoperatively. However, as the next slide indicates, I think we have to acknowledge some significant limitations to this study. First of all, they used a real-time PCR assay for the prompt initiation of their intervention, and at this point in time, that's probably not generalizable. The vast majority of hospitals would not have a real-time PCR assay available to do this. Now, that's not a major limitation of the study. It just means that you would have to organize, if you were interested in doing this intervention, you'd have to organize your preoperative assessment to include a culture given with enough advance notice that you could then intervene at the time of surgery. However, a second limitation, which may or may not be relevant, is the fact that because the study was done in the Netherlands, they had virtually no MRSA. In fact, none of their patients were colonized with MRSA. This was all susceptible Staph aureus, and there may be a difference in the efficacy of the intervention in MRSA versus susceptible strains of Staph aureus. The third limitation, in my mind, is perhaps the most important. And that is that although they did detect a decrease in Staph aureus surgical site infection rates, they did not look at overall infection rates. And obviously, there's no benefit if you reduce Staph aureus, but you don't benefit the overall rates because you replace the Staph aureus with some other organism. Now, the reality is that may not have occurred in this study. Although they didn't look at their overall surgical site infection rates, they did look at overall length of admission. And in fact, the length of admission in patients who were randomized to mupirocin chlorhexidine was reduced as compared to those who received the placebo. And that would perhaps suggest that there was no overall increase in surgical site infections. But it doesn't definitively document it, and that really would have been important in this study. But those are the data with regards to using decolonization in operative patients. The next slide turns to randomized controlled trials in non-surgical patients. And there have been only 3 randomized controlled trials. They're summarized in this table. The first one, a large study, also done in the Netherlands, looked at medical inpatients who were colonized with Staph aureus. And again, because it was the Netherlands, it was almost all susceptible strains of Staph aureus. And in this study, 1,627 of these colonized inpatients were randomized to decolonization either with mupirocin or a placebo. And as you can see, there was no significant decrease in follow-up nosocomial infection rates. The second study, much smaller, took place in Geneva in Switzerland, and these patients were all colonized with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and again, randomized to either mupirocin or placebo. And although there was a trend to a decreased infection rate with mupirocin, this was not statistically significant, possibly because of the small sample size. The third study involves not acute care hospital patients, but rather long-term care facility patients in the United States long-term care facility. About half of these patients were colonized with MRSA, the other half with susceptible Staph aureus, again randomized to decolonization with either mupirocin or a placebo. And again, in this study, there was also a trend to reduced infection rate in the mupirocin recipients, but not statistically significant, again, possibly because of a small sample size, but I think the reality is that medical patients who are colonized are at a lower risk of developing subsequent infection than surgical patients anyway, so you really do need a much larger sample size if you're going to show any significant difference. But the reality is the best data we have available at this point in time does not suggest that there is any benefit in terms of preventing infection in staphylococcal medical or non-surgical patients. Moving to the next slide, we look at another high-risk group, and that is intensive care unit patients. This study illustrated here, published earlier this year in the Infection Control Hospital Epidemiology, is not a randomized controlled trial. Rather, it's a quasi-experimental before and after study in a medical intensive care unit. This ICU also used real-time PCR screening to identify Staph aureus carriage on admission to the unit. And then those who were identified as being staphylococcal carriers were offered decolonization, again, with a combination of mupirocin intranasally and chlorhexidine baths in the intensive care unit. In this before and after study, ICU-acquired Staph aureus infections were found to decrease once the mupirocin chlorhexidine baths were offered to the staphylococcal carriers who were identified using the real-time PCR. Importantly, this is not a randomized controlled trial. The next slide just highlights the significance of MRSA in ICU settings. The prevalence of MRSA on admission to ICUs has been found to be on average about 8%, with a 5% rate of acquisition in the ICU. And again, those who acquire MRSA in an ICU are at a substantial risk of developing an MRSA infection. So the next slide just summarizes a number of studies, again, all of them before and after observational studies done in ICUs, some of them done in neonatal ICUs, using mupirocin and or chlorhexidine body wash. And all of these observational studies using historic controls have shown reduced MRSA infection rates. But importantly, there have not been any properly conducted randomized controlled trials in this patient population to guide us. The good news, however, is shown in the next slide, which is a study published earlier this year describing a study that is currently underway. And this study is, in fact, a cluster randomized controlled trial attempting to prevent MRSA infections in ICUs involving 45 hospitals. These ICUs will be randomized to either active staphylococcal surveillance cultures, that's what ASC refers to, plus implementation of contact precautions, or they may be randomized to the active surveillance plus the precautions plus decolonization, or alternatively, they may be randomized to universal decolonization. This study is currently underway. Results hopefully will be available within the next couple of years and will give us more definitive answers as to whether decolonization of ICU patients with Staph aureus colonization or MRSA colonization makes sense or not. So stay tuned. That data will be forthcoming, hopefully, in the next few years. In the next slide, I'd now like to turn to another high-risk patient population, and that is dialysis patient populations, both hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. And the next slide summarizes the results of a meta-analysis that was published in Clinical Infectious Diseases in 2003. And what they did is, in their meta-analysis, they did a systematic review summarizing studies that looked at decolonization using mupirocin in dialysis patient populations. On your left, hemodialysis, where they found overall in their meta-analysis a 78% decrease in Staph aureus bloodstream infections in those patients receiving mupirocin decolonization. And on your right, in the peritoneal dialysis patient population, an overall 66% decrease in Staph aureus peritonitis rates in these CAPD patient populations. So if you just looked at this meta-analysis, you'd say to yourself, well, that's pretty good evidence that decolonization with mupirocin is effective in these patient populations. The problem that you have to recognize is that very few of the studies included in this meta-analysis were actually randomized controlled trials. Again, the majority of these studies were before and after studies using historic controls or other quasi-experimental design. So I'd now like to take you through the more definitive studies, which are the randomized controlled trials. Starting on the next slide, the randomized controlled trials of staphylococcal decolonization in chronic hemodialysis patients. And thus far, there have been three randomized controlled trials, and they're summarized here. The first thing you'll immediately notice is that they're all pretty small sample sizes. The largest study involved all of 44 patients, the smallest 34 patients. The first study, which was the earliest study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, randomized hemodialysis patients to receive oral treatment with rifampin plus topical treatment with bacitracin ointment versus no treatment at all. And in that study, there was a benefit. The patients treated with rifampin and bacitracin had a substantially lower rate of Staph aureus infections than those who were not treated. The problem with this study was that over time, the isolates, the Staph aureus isolates, developed rifampin resistance. And as they became rifampin resistant, the benefits of the intervention were lost. So the reality is we should not be using rifampin, certainly not rifampin as the sole systemic therapy in this patient population, because it may work temporarily, but not in the long run. The other two studies randomized patients to receive either topical mupirocin or placebo, or in the second study, mupirocin versus nothing. In the second study, the smallest study with only 34 patients, there was a benefit found. But as you can see, the sample size was so small, the confidence intervals extended on both sides of one and therefore not statistically significant. The third study, SESO's study, did show a statistically significant benefit. So that's the good news. The bad news is you can see the study was published in 1998. And in fact, in their hemodialysis unit, they've been using mupirocin routinely since that time. Excuse me. And what they have found over time is a gradual increase in mupirocin resistance. And this mupirocin resistance has been associated with decreased efficacy. So that is definitely a concern. The next slide highlights the only two published randomized controlled trials of decolonization in peritoneal dialysis patients. The first study compares patients who received treatment with mupirocin to placebo, and there was a significantly reduced Staph aureus infection rate in this study. Unfortunately, the majority of these infections were Staph aureus exit site infections, not peritonitis, which is of greater interest. The second study, and again, this is a bit of a cheat because it's not really a study of staphylococcal decolonization, but at any rate, they randomized patients to either receive topical mupirocin or to receive topical gentamicin. And in fact, the patients randomized to receive gentamicin had a better outcome. They had significantly reduced overall peritonitis rates. And most of that was related to decreased gram-negative infections, not the Staph aureus infections. But if you're going to decolonize peritoneal dialysis patients, it seems that gentamicin is superior to mupirocin. I'd like to move now into a more difficult realm, and I say more difficult because the reality is we don't have good randomized controlled trials here. And the first realm I'd like to address is that of patients who have frequently recurrent skin and soft tissue infections due to Staph aureus. This is an epidemic curve in a community where they had significant Staph aureus skin and soft tissue infections in their community. These were all methicillin-susceptible strains, but they happened to be PVL positive. That is, they had the pantovalentine leukocyte, and so they were perceived as being more virulent. And you can see that as part of their control measure, they finally decided to use mupirocin and antiseptics as a decolonization measure, and it was shortly after this that the outbreak appeared to have been aborted and finally stopped. Obviously, it's not conclusive evidence, but it is suggestive that this approach might be of value. In contrast, this was an outbreak of skin and soft tissue infection due to community-associated strains of MRSA involving members of a high school football team, where the intervention, mupirocin decolonization, was not effective in preventing subsequent infections, although the authors here say that perhaps the lack of efficacy was because of the lack of compliance. Among this high school football team, they only had about 36% compliance with the recommended mupirocin treatment. The next slide does show two randomized control trials using mupirocin to prevent recurrent skin and soft tissue infections. The first study was recurrent skin and soft tissue infections caused by susceptible strains of Staph aureus. Individuals received monthly treatments with mupirocin for a year, and there was a significant reduction in subsequent staphylococcal skin and soft tissue infections in the mupirocin-treated individuals. So that's encouraging. In contrast, the second study in military recruits colonized and infected with community-associated MRSA, there was no benefit. So again, the theme here suggests that mupirocin seems to be effective in eradicating staphylococcal carriage and preventing recurrent Staph aureus skin and soft tissue infections if it's a susceptible strain, but it appears to be less effective if you have a methicillin-resistant strain. Next slide just carries us over then into MRSA and the use of this strategy in MRSA patients. Next slide just comments the role of MRSA decolonization and highlights there have been many, and I've just on this slide put a handful, many, many observational studies where mupirocin was used or other agents were used as decolonization as part of infection prevention and control measures in both hospitals and nursing homes. And because they were typically used as part of other control measures, it's really not possible to determine whether decolonization by itself had any effectiveness or not. On the bottom half of this slide is a recent study by Ari Robicek in Chicago. This was a retrospective observational study in three Chicago hospitals where they did routine, almost universal MRSA screening on admission, and then they initially they routinely decolonized, but subsequently decolonized at the physician's discretion. And what they found was, yes, they had transient eradication of the MRSA, but there was in fact no reduced risk of subsequent infection. And again, these results were very similar to the results I showed previously in the randomized control trial in non-surgical patients, where there really wasn't any effect in reducing overall risk of staphylococcal infections. So the next slide summarizes a Cochrane database systematic review that concluded, this was in 2003, there is insufficient evidence to support the use of topical or systemic antimicrobial therapy for eradicating MRSA. And although this is now 7 years out of date, there really are no new compelling data that would change this conclusion. So the next slide tries to indicate why there may be failure to eradicate MRSA, especially with mupirocin or other agents. So first of all, in some of the studies, drugs were used that in fact had only marginal activity against MRSA or that induced resistance. So ciprofloxacin and fusidic acid have clearly failed as decolonizing agents for this reason. If you're using mupirocin alone applied into the nares, intranasal therapy may be ineffective for extranasal sites of MRSA carriage. And there's some data to suggest that if you're carrying in the nose, you may also chronically carry it in the GI tract, and carrying it in the nose won't work. Treatment in the nose won't work for these extranasal sites. And thirdly, host factors such as the presence of chronic skin lesions, medical devices, catheters, and other comorbidities may also contribute to failure of MRSA decolonization. In fact, the next slide highlights studies that have looked at variables associated with decolonization failure, or to look at it from the other perspective, variables associated with persistence or recolonization with MRSA. And variables that have been found including having MRSA at multiple sites, having mupirocin resistance appears to be a factor. So if your isolate is resistant to mupirocin, then using mupirocin for decolonization is unlikely to work. And that, by the way, would suggest that if you're considering decolonization for MRSA, mupirocin susceptibility testing should be done. Other variables associated with failure have included residents in a long-term care facility and the presence of decubitus ulcers. So the next slide just refers to the concern of mupirocin resistance, and there's no question as mupirocin is more and more widely used, mupirocin resistance rates have been increasing globally. This has been a particular problem in methicillin-resistant strains of Staph aureus. Mupirocin resistance in susceptible strains of Staph aureus remains rare. This resistance has been most closely associated with extensive use of mupirocin. Where mupirocin is used widely, that's the setting where you're going to get mupirocin resistance. And certainly this resistance, especially so-called high-level resistance, is associated with treatment failure. So the next slide is just my own musing, speculation, as to if mupirocin alone is not terrific for long-term eradication of MRSA carriage, can we do anything that might improve the efficacy? And so one possibility, and some studies have suggested, maybe adding an antiseptic body wash like chlorhexidine might improve the effectiveness. Our own study, we looked at adding systemic antibiotics to the mupirocin. So in our study, we used mupirocin plus the chlorhexidine body wash plus oral doxycycline and oral rifampin. And that combination together for 7 days appeared to have superior eradication of MRSA as compared to no treatment or using mupirocin alone. And in our study, we had long-term, that is at least 6 months decolonization in 60 to 70% of patients. And another strategy might be decolonization of household contacts, use of hot water, laundering of clothes and bedding and linens in order to try to eradicate an inanimate reservoir for the organism or some other potential for reacquisition of MRSA colonization after successful treatment with the mupirocin. So I think these are other strategies that need to be considered. The next slide is just to move away from the data that I've presented, and I hope the data that I've presented, and I've tried to do it as objectively as possible, but I hope I've shown you that the data is truly not wonderful. There isn't terrific evidence to show that decolonization is wonderfully effective in most patient populations. Notwithstanding that, the next few slides just illustrate how widespread decolonization is. And this is from a study that was published in Infection Control Hospital Epidemiology a few years ago. It was an Infectious Diseases Society of America Emerging Infections Network survey that was done in 2005 to try to determine decolonization use among IDSA members. And as you can see, 17% indicated that they did do routine preoperative decolonization of Staph aureus carriers, most often in patients undergoing cardiac surgery, most often using mupirocin. In about a fifth of responders, they did use MRSA decolonization for infection control about half the time in outbreaks. About 38% said in anyone who was colonized with MRSA. And again, the majority used mupirocin. Next slide, just continuing with this survey, 85% used decolonization for patients with recurrent furunculosis due to community-associated MRSA. And again, in this setting, most respondents used a combination of mupirocin plus an antiseptic body wash, and some also used an oral antimicrobial agent. And in this survey, there was no data on outcome or efficacy. None of the respondents had any outcome data. The next slide is more recent from Europe, a survey conducted in European intensive care units and surgical units, where again, two-thirds in Europe used routine antiseptic washing, such as with chlorhexidine, and almost the same number used routine decolonization with mupirocin. So it is being widely used, even though the evidence is less than ideal. So I would like to just conclude in my last two slides with my own personal recommendations, and I will highlight they are personal. I'm not aware of any evidence-based published guidelines that we can rely on, and if they were, they would really be consensus opinions or personal opinions anyway, based on most of the data that's available. But in my opinion, I would not recommend routine preoperative decolonization, nor would I routinely recommend it in non-surgical patients. However, especially based on the Bode study and perhaps with Trish Pearl's data in their subset, it would at least be reasonable to consider it in surgical patients who are known to be Staph aureus carriers preoperatively. Secondly, again, reasonable to consider in dialysis patients, but based on the randomized controlled trials, but we need to be aware that in this patient population, it's going to be long-term recurrent use of mupirocin, and that will increase the risk of mupirocin resistance in the long term. Next slide. It may be useful in patients with recurrent skin and soft tissue infections. Most of the success is seen with recurrent infections caused by susceptible strains of Staph aureus. I think we need much more data for community-associated strains. If one is going to do decolonization with mupirocin for patients carrying MRSA, mupirocin susceptibility testing should be done because high-level mupirocin resistance predicts treatment failure. And lastly, if we're going to consider decolonization as an MRSA infection control measure, at the moment the only data is when it's used in conjunction with other measures. It really needs to be better studied as an infection control measure. Again, one might consider it in outbreaks or select patients. Similarly, better data need to come from our ICU patients, and hopefully that data will be forthcoming. And with that, I will conclude, and I would be happy to answer any comments or questions. Thank you very much.
Well, Dr. Seymour, thank you very much. So I guess the final word on decolonizing staff patients is that there is no final word on decolonization staff patients, right?
I think that's true. The best evidence is in a subset of surgical patients who are known to be colonized with Staph aureus preoperatively, and even there recognize some of the study limitations. Similarly, there is some data, not wonderful, but some data supporting decolonization in dialysis patients. Again, important limitations to those data. There is very weak evidence in any other patient, weak to no evidence for other patient populations.
I'm an infection control practitioner, and we have probably thousands and thousands of patients who have been identified as MRSA colonized or infected in this country, and we have them on alert for their readmission to the hospital, and they automatically go on contact precautions. Now, I've looked across the country, and to discontinue isolation practices, most of the provinces are recommending that to consider it only if decolonization therapy has been done. How do you feel about doing that?
It's a great question, and I think all of us across the country have a real quandary in terms of knowing when it is safe to discontinue isolation precautions. I think it's important to note the current state of decolonization therapy for MRSA is by no means 100% effective. At best, it may be 60 to 70% long-term effectiveness. So I personally believe it's a mistake to assume just because you've decolonized someone and their first three cultures are negative that you can automatically assume they're going to stay negative indefinitely. So I think you can use whatever criteria for discontinuing the isolation precautions, but I think you have to maintain vigilance and alertness and, if appropriate, retest them when they're readmitted to make sure they are still negative, because they may not be.
Just wondering what you would recommend, Dr. Seymour, for the actual therapy if you were to try and decolonize, if they met that very specific subset, would you just do the mupirocin or the mupirocin, systemic antibiotic, and chlorhexidine.
So again, I'll answer by my own bias, because there hasn't been a controlled study to guide us. But my own bias is, if you're going to try to decolonize for MRSA, then our recommendation is a combination of topical mupirocin plus a body wash like chlorhexidine or potentially triclosan, plus systemic agents. And the systemic agents that we've had the most experience with is oral rifampin and oral doxycycline, although you could also consider oral clotrimoxazole. At any rate, it's topical therapy, antiseptic wash, plus systemic agents. That combination together for a total of 7 days. And at the same time, if you can, if they're outside of hospital, encourage them to use hot water laundry during that period of time as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
If I may, Paul, in follow-up to the question in terms of which subset of patients you might consider decolonizing, obviously there would be a benefit if the decolonization did work. And in general, we've recommended it for MRSA patients who are systemically recovered from whatever acute illness they had, who are not receiving other antibiotics for some other infection, who do not have medical devices in place, so they don't have feeding tubes and IV lines, or they don't have a tracheostomy in place, and who do not have chronic skin lesions or decubitus ulcers. Those are the patients, I think, where your chances of successful eradication are the greatest and who potentially would benefit the most from decolonization. In our experience, if they've got an indwelling catheter, if they've got a medical device or a decubitus ulcer or a wound, decolonization is not likely to succeed in the long run.
Do you recommend a screening for methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus for preoperative for patients coming to surgery?
Well, that's a great question, and I can tell you, first of all, that we're not currently doing it at our hospital, and I don't think many hospitals in Canada are, but if you believe the Bode study in particular, then the answer is we probably should be doing it, but it depends on whether you believe the results of their study, because, as I say, they did have some limitations that need to be acknowledged.
Thank you for those fabulous questions. Dr. Seymour, again, thank you very much for another tremendous presentation. This is your third teleclass. The first two of yours are available in the recordings library. That is free access for anybody, and they do get a lot of hits. Our recordings library gets around 10,000 hits a month, and a lot of them go to yours. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And
thank you to all for listening.
My comments exactly. Thank you to everyone else, and we will look forward to speaking with you again very soon. Goodbye.